The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition this week. I know Jim's got a couple of Social Security questions to start off with. Then he's going to surprise us with future questions, so I can't share with you the topics of today other than to know that we've got a couple of Social Security questions. So welcome, Jim. Happy Friday to you.
Thank you, Chris. You didn't tell everyone that I'm in the remote underground bunker in a secret location, otherwise known as my kitchen table.
I think they know that immediately as soon as they hear your voice, because it has that special quality to it that is only available over the phone.
Yes, folks, I am not in the office today. I had intended actually to take Friday off, but for a variety of reasons that did not happen. So I'm working from home and recording the show from here. So hopefully no one will mind the phone voice today, but Chris is going to lead with some Social Security questions. I've got a short one that I can read in two sentences, and a longer one that would be a full multi-sentence paragraph. Which would you want to lead with?
Let's do the short one first. Get warmed up on that one.
Okay. This comes to us from someone, I don't know who, going to call him George anyways, but he doesn't give his state of residence. Usually they do, but he didn't. Okay. He writes, if I claim my Social Security at 70, would I be better off actually claiming at 69 and 11 months? My birthday is May 3rd. So if I claim at the end of April, I will get a check for May. But if I wait until I'm 70, I won't get a check for May and will have to wait until June. What do you think would be better for me to do?
That is a short and sweet question. The real dilemma, if you will, is small ramifications to either one, I guess. The difference is if you claim a month early, you give up 1 month of delayed retirement credits, where if you wait until you're actually 70, you get all of your delayed retirement credits. So you're going to give up 0.67% of your benefits, which is tiny, of course. So it's going to be, you know, if you've got a $1,000 benefit, for every $1,000 of your benefit, you're going to give up $6.67 per month for the rest of your life by claiming it 1 month early. That's the difference. So I don't know that there's a huge deal. I think it's probably more important if you're going to delay something in your life or you're going to give up something in your life that's of significance to you by missing out on that 1 month of payment. It's probably worth it giving up the $667 every month for the rest of your life per $1,000, right? If you have a $2,000 benefit, it's going to be double that you're going to give up for the rest of your life by not getting that last month's of delayed retirement credit. So There is a difference in the amount he would receive between claiming the month before he turned 70 and the month he actually turned 70. So I guess that's what he's going to have to weigh. There's not a one-size-fits-all answer to this particular question. It kind of depends on how badly you need it. If you need it badly, I can't imagine it's too badly, or you wouldn't be delaying to 70. You would have turned on the benefit already. But if you want to get your full delayed retirement credits, you've got to wait until you're actually 70. Now, that being said, you would go in and apply before that, right? The other way he's going to miss out on a payment as early as he might want is waiting until he's 70 and then going in and asking for a benefit to start. Because the problem with that is it takes him a while to process. And I've heard some stories where it's taking extra long to process. So even when people go in the 3 months before they want to claim, they're having a little difficulty with the benefit starting on time. So I would say 3 months or so, 3 to 4 months before you want to claim, you want to actually notify Social Security, whether it's online, if you're comfortable with that, or going in to see someone at the local Social Security office. You're going to want to get them starting the wheels turning, if you will, to get that deposit ready to go as soon as you qualify or as soon as you tell them you want them to start. Because if you wait until the month you want it to start, it'll be too late. They will make it right eventually, but it'll take a few months for them to finally get the payment started and then also give you an extra deposit for the couple months that they may miss because you didn't go in time. So always remember that. That rule has nothing to do with him turning 70. That's more a general rule. Whenever you want your benefits to start, they recommend you go in 3 months before that. You notify them 3 months before you want your benefits to start and gives them time for all the things they have to do apparently in the back room to make that actually happen.
Okay, this one is a little bit longer to read, and it comes to us again. He is George from Wisconsin, but recently moved to Arizona.
Okay.
So he went from the cold to brutally hot. That's quite the move he did there.
Unless he's in the mountains in Arizona, it's not as hot. There are kind of mountainy areas.
So instead of 120, it's 108?
I guess it is all relative.
Yeah, Arizona's hot and dry. That's all I know. Ugh. All right. It says, hi, a few background facts. So you might want to write some of these down. I have no idea.
Okay.
My full retirement age is 66 and 2 months, which will be September of 2021.
Okay.
I started taking my Social Security retirement benefits this year, March of 2020.
Okay.
It is now October of 2020, and I'm going to start working again full time. So now I want to withdraw my Social Security benefit since I am still within the first 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
My plan is to now instead work until I'm 70 and start drawing my higher age 70 benefit at that time. I know I have to pay back all the money that has been paid to me so far, and I have had federal tax taken out of the payments, 12% each time. Are those taxes factored into the amount that I have to pay back? I never actually received those dollars, so do I have to pay them back, or do I get them back at tax time? Also, since I started Medicare in July, what happens to the $144 a month that is taken out automatically from my Social Security? Is that just kept by Social Security, or do I have to pay that back to Medicare? I can't seem to find an answer on the Social Security website.
Mm-hmm. Excellent questions that we haven't covered before. So what's going to happen here is just some clarification for people who might not understand how he started this whole story. He started his benefit and then something changed in his life. In this particular case, he's going back to work and he would like to undo his application for benefits. That's what he means by withdraw his application. what that effectively does is resets it as if you had never claimed in the first place. It's kind of a do-over. They provide you one chance in a lifetime to do this, and you must do it within the first 12 months of claiming your benefit. And as he pointed out, you have to pay back all the benefits that they have paid to you, all the benefits they've paid to you and any others on your record. So if a spouse was collecting a spousal benefit or kids were collecting a secondary benefit, all that would have to be paid back. So everything that they paid as a result of you claiming your benefit has to be paid back to them. Now, the good news is you don't have to figure out what that is. When you apply for the withdrawal, they will send you a letter with exactly how much you owe them, and they'll give you, we did a show on this before. You've got a certain period of time, I believe it's about 30 days, in order to pay that. And that's what will finalize the withdrawal. And once you do that and pay them the amount that they demand, you will be considered having never claimed your Social Security in the first place. So then you can go about your business and, like him, delay in his case until 70, get all the delayed retirement credits as if nothing had ever happened. So that's the basic story. He has a couple of specific questions, though. He had taxes withheld from the benefit. So in other words, his gross benefit, say $1,000 a month, he didn't give us any numbers, but just to use it, some simple numbers, $1,000 a month, and let's pretend $150 a month went to the federal government in withholding. So he only got $850 every single month deposited to his account, less the Medicare, which we'll go over in a second. But just for taxes, he's got $850 left. That $150 they've paid to the IRS, they've sent, and it's never coming back to them. That doesn't get undone. When they send you the demand letter for what you owe them, they're going to consider the entire $1,000, the total benefit that they paid out. The fact that they paid some of it to the IRS and some of it to Medicare in your Part B premiums that were being withheld, that's on you to fix that, essentially. So they're going to demand the whole amount back. And the taxes that were sent in, when you fill out your taxes, it's just going to be like withholding from an employer. If the withholding shows up at the tax at the IRS, and when you do your taxes next year in 2021 for the tax year 2020, those will just be extra tax withholdings that you'll report and will be recorded at the IRS. And if you've over withheld, you get a refund. And if you still owe more money, you pay more money. So it's just as if the Social Security was your employer and they had withheld those taxes. They're not going to contact the IRS and suck those taxes back. They're going to expect you to pay them the full amount that they paid out. And then you will reconcile things with the IRS just like you would have with withholding from a job. On the Medicare side, same exact thing. If you hadn't claimed Social Security, you would have had to pay those Medicare premiums out of pocket. So by the Social Security Administration making you pay the whole $1,000 back, in my example, if that was your benefit, you're effectively having paid out of your pocket those Medicare premiums. Now, moving forward, since you're not claiming Social Security anymore, once the withdrawal has finalized and they've stopped your Social Security benefit payments, you will then start paying quarterly for those Medicare Part B premiums out of pocket. So he didn't say anything about trying to stop the Medicare. Technically, if you went back to work and you had an employer with a medical plan that was sufficient to qualify as a substitute for Medicare, met all the rules, you could technically, in my understanding, is stop participating in Medicare. He didn't mention anything about that, so I assume he's going to stay on Medicare, but there are some options possibly there depending on his employer situation. But the part that's already happened, he's going to have to come up with that money to pay it back, just like he would have. The assumption from Social Security is you would have had to have come up with the money and paid it to Medicare anyway if you weren't claiming Social Security. So if you want to pretend like you never filed, you have to have paid these things like you never filed, the Medicare premiums specifically here. The federal tax withholding, that's a kind of a strange one, but the nice thing is you don't lose anything. It's just as if you had sent in extra withholding during the year to the IRS. And my guess is if you're going back to work, you're going to owe some taxes. So you might not end up really in any worse position than before, other than it sounds like he's concerned about a couple of these things because of the amount he's going to be demanded to pay back in order to pull off a withdrawal of his application. He is going to have to come up with the total gross amount of his benefit that he was paid, even though he never got into his pocket the Medicare Part B premium, nor the tax withholding that was happening. So hopefully that clarifies how that all works. The good news is you won't have to, again, come up with the number. You don't have to do any math. You just file the application for a withdrawal of your benefits, which I don't have that form in front of me, but if you go to our blog, you can find it on there. Our blog is helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, the blog specifically for Social Security. Retirementandirashow.com is where you get kind of the main show website, but helpwithmysocialsecurity.com has specific Social Security resources on there, and then a lot of Q&A where I've answered people's questions in the past. But there is, we have talked about how to actually pull off a withdrawal of benefits, and there's a blog post or two on there about that with the actual form, a reference to the form that you fill out. You fill that out, send it into Social Security. There'll be some period of time where they figure out what you owe them. They'll do all the calculations, and then they'll send you a demand letter that says to finalize this withdrawal, you have to pay this by a certain date. And if you don't, then we'll consider you didn't want to do the withdrawal, but if you send us this much money, we will process the withdrawal, stop your benefits, and we'll call it off like nothing ever happened. That's essentially the steps you would take to pull that off. So I think that Jim answered all the elements of his particular question.
Bit unique. I think you did.
We've talked about the withdrawals before, but we haven't talked about the tax withholding and what happens to those Medicare Part B premiums that were sent in. So that's an excellent question. And he's right. This level of detail is not readily available on the internet. The way I find out about these is I usually have run across someone who's experienced it before, and they share how this actually happens, or I do have a couple of resources of people that worked for Social Security that I can ask them, hey, you've worked in the office, how does this actually work? Because usually on the website, they talk about it in kind of at a high level. They don't get into the gritty details of exactly what the steps that happen and the transactions that happen. So only people usually that work there know how the inner workings take place. And I've asked them similar questions to like this before. So that's how I discover these answers. It's not that I have some special knowledge, if you will. It's just hard to dig up. So anyway.
All right. So those were some Social Security questions. We're going to get into a few non-Social Security questions now. And if we still have time, I'll chuck another Social Security question or two out there. We got a bunch of Social Security questions in lately, probably because you stole all the other ones and then lost them, and people are just trying to make up for it. Okay. This one begins. This is from, again, he doesn't say his state. Tells me his name and where he works, but we're going to call him George to protect his anonymity. But he begins, hello, Jim and Chris. On your most recent EDU show, Jim made a statement about a new spouse needing to sign a waiver for a 401k in order for the children beneficiaries to be recognized. And that is correct, folks. If you haven't listened to that EDU show, it was EDU 2041, where we get into, really, it kind of morphed a little bit off from what I thought we were going to talk about, Chris, but it kind of covered a lot of blended family planning and naming beneficiaries, especially children beneficiaries, on 401k accounts or accounts that are governed by ERISA, as opposed to IRA accounts, which are accounts that are not governed by ERISA, and how many people, many decedents, unfortunately, they pass away. They think they did things right, but then they pass away. And accounts that they had hoped to go to children were going to second spouses, even if those spouses were only married to them. In one case, if you remember, Chris, it was a matter of weeks, just a few weeks, and the gentleman died. And then the other one, it was, I think, 3 months, and then the person died. But in very short periods of time, children were being disinherited. And we wanted to share the reasons behind that, that even if children were named on the beneficiary form, it is possible a brand new spouse could inherit the 401k. And it's something important that people need to know in blended family situations. So you can listen to that whole EDU show. We're not going to get into it. But what he stated is correct. I did say that in order for a spouse to, I guess, disinherit herself or himself from inheriting a 401k, they must sign a spousal waiver. So that part is true. Then he goes on. What if the spouse has to wait until after they are married to sign the form? Well, obviously they do have to wait.
It isn't what if, they have to do that. Yeah.
And then that spouse says they're not going to sign. What option does the 401k owner have at that point but to file for divorce, under which circumstances the new spouse will receive half the 401k anyway? Isn't this correct? Well, I'm not a divorce attorney, nor have I ever been divorced, because one must be married in order to get divorced. However, I know in the state of Colorado, their divorce laws are 5% to the spouse each year they are married. So I would assume in this up to 50%. So it takes 10 years for a spouse in Colorado to lay claim to half of a divorced spouse's assets. So in your scenario, at least in Colorado, I don't know, there's 49 other states out there. I don't know, Chris, if there's any states that say immediately upon marriage, the spouse is entitled to half, and if they divorce even after a day, they get half. I don't think that state exists, but I'm not a divorce attorney, nor do I play one on TV. So if there is a divorce attorney listening to this and the advice Chris is giving is wrong, please speak up so I can correct Chris in public on this show and maybe get you on as a guest. Does that sound reasonable, Chris?
Yeah, I think let's connect a couple of the dots back to that original post or podcast that we did just recently. It was last week.
Right, and that's why I wanted to get this question on, because it's so fresh in people's minds.
So with that, we remember some 401ks do not grant the wife automatic beneficiary status for up to a year. So depending on the 401k that we're talking about, you might have time to get divorced and or annulled or something before they've become the default beneficiary. Now, if it's immediately, then it's in the scenario he's worried about, that what have I, you know, what's going to happen? They're already the beneficiary of my 401k by the 401k's rules, and they refuse to sign the spousal waiver. This is kind of a tricky legal issue. And I also am not a lawyer, nor do I play one on television. I would think if these facts were put in front of a judge, I think it'd be pretty easy to get an annulment. She or he clearly was trying to take advantage of me, had no intention of being married to me, just did this to get half my 401k.
Right, but I honestly don't think, Chris, a spouse is entitled to half merely because they were married. And boom, they're getting a divorce right away.
Yeah, I think in most states there's going to be a length of marriage time that's going to play into it, and it's not an automatic thing. The divorce, the judge rendering the divorce laws in the state is going to look at the whole time, the length of the marriage, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, to undo this, if they're refusing to sign the spousal waiver, if you continue to be married to them, they will be eventually the beneficiary of that 401k.
Now, let me point out something, though, listeners. He doesn't list the state he's in. In community property states, on a lump sum distribution from a 401k, you do have to get spousal waiver. But in the other 42 states that are not community property states, you generally do not need to get a spousal signature for a lump sum payout from an ERISA-protected 401k.
So that's good news. That's right, because those 42 states, you could just pull all the money out. The other thing I was saying, if you're to the point where you can pull all the money out, before you get married, roll it out to an IRA.
Right.
That would be another thing you could do to, if you were worried they were pulling the wool over your eyes and were going to try to attack your 401k.
Right. I do want to point out, when Chris uses the verbiage pull all your money out, he means roll it over to an IRA. So if you are married and your spouse refuses to sign a spousal waiver, now, granted, there's going to be some animosity going on here way beyond the value of the 401k here, folks. Right. But to answer this listener's question, one strategy, depending on the state he lives in, assuming you no longer work for that company, listener, and you can move your 401k, or assuming the 401k, you've reached an age where an in-service distribution of not only your contributions, but your employer matches, the whole kit and caboodle, so to speak, can be removed. If you are on that or in either of those scenarios, and the 401k does not force, in non-community property states, spousal consent on a distribution, you could move the 401k to an IRA and then name any beneficiary you want. Mm-hmm. Literally, you can name your children, you could name your spouse, you could name your favorite podcast host as beneficiary of that IRA. And the spouse has no say. That's what's unique about IRAs. IRAs can, you can disinherit a spouse with an IRA. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to disinherit a spouse with a 401k because of the ERISA rules. But if you move it to an IRA, it's very easy. And to me, that's a glaring loophole in ERISA, Chris, mm-hmm. that ERISA doesn't require a spousal consent on the transfer of a 401k to an IRA. It's bizarre. But nonetheless, in a pension, though, it always requires spousal consent. For the pension payout and the lump sum distribution from a pension, you must get spousal consent. But from a 401k, it's not required. Kind of bizarre, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah. Well, it's bizarre and hard to follow. All these different types of accounts and situations have slightly different rules. And I guess that's why people listen to shows like this, is to clarify that. That's why we have to continue studying and keeping up on this, because it can be complicated. And one rule that seems to make sense in one scenario doesn't apply in another scenario, just because that's the way the rules were written.
Right. But an ERISA-protected pension always will require spousal consent. But an ERISA-protected 401k does not on a lump sum distribution. However, I have seen many 401ks put that requirement in place. Yeah. So you may not be in a community property state, but your 401k is still going to require spousal consent. If you're in a community property state, I have always seen the spousal consent requirement be there, because in a community property state, that account is considered half of the spouses. So community property states would be a little bit different. And to his first point, I do want to point out something that we mentioned on this show before, but it's a very famous court case. And you'll remember this one, Chris. There was an ERISA attorney, an actual ERISA attorney. What did he study, Chris, or practice in?
The laws about ERISA.
ERISA law, exactly. The Employee Retirement Income Security Act. There was an attorney who specialized in ERISA, was getting married for the second time. And he had his fiance sign mm-hmm. a prenuptial agreement. And in the prenuptial agreement, the fiance agreed she would not inherit what, Chris?
The 401k.
His 401k. He had his second wife-to-be sign that agreement. This is a true story, folks. Mm-hmm. Signed that agreement. He left his children as beneficiary of his what, Chris?
His 401k.
His 401k. What happened to this poor gentleman after he got married? This seems to be a regular occurrence. This is why I'm not married. What happened to this man after he said, I do?
Let's say the relationship didn't evolve the way he'd hoped. And no. Things kind of fell apart, and they headed to divorce.
Actually, they didn't head to divorce in this case. He kicked the bucket.
Oh, I thought this was one where he was getting okay.
No, he kicked the bucket.
Okay, so he kicked the bucket. Oh, so you were, I'm getting a couple things mixed up. You were making that comment about marriage because you're thinking that the marriage itself caused his early demise.
It does. It seems to cause early demise in men. Every single case we discussed on this topic, the guy dies right after marrying the woman. Anyways, I don't know how far after marriage, all jokes aside, when anyone passes away, I have no idea how long after the marriage this gentleman passed away. It might have been immediately. It might have been years. I don't know. But the case ended up in court. Why?
Right. The kids wanted it. The wife was going to take it.
Mm-hmm. And had the prenup.
Yeah.
And was showing it.
Yeah.
And the wife got it.
Yep.
And this is from an ERISA attorney. That's why this case is so famous. Because who should have known better, Chris? But
of anybody, someone who specializes in these rules.
And his mistake was, folks, having the wife sign the prenup and not a postnup.
Right.
Or they wouldn't even have to sign the postnup. You would have to sign, let me stand corrected. She can still sign a prenup for everything else. But immediately upon marriage, or at least at some point after marriage, she should have signed the spousal waiver form from that 401k. There have been other cases where spouses have signed spousal waiver forms that attorneys have created, Chris,
right,
and then won the case saying that this is not an appropriate spousal waiver form. And I always recommend just get the spousal waiver form that the 401k wants you to sign.
Right.
And then the spouse would sign that. So the mistake the gentleman made isn't even having her sign a postnup. It was she should have signed a spousal waiver form. It should have been, do you so-and-so take so-and-so? I do. And as soon as she said, I do, there should have been someone there just sliding this right in front of her, handing her a pen and saying, sign here, please. But maybe that would have taken the romance out of the wedding, of course. But all jokes aside, that was the mistake he made. Mm-hmm. So I just want to point that out, folks. A prenup where the spouse says, I don't want access to these items, don't worry, I hereby give them up, is not going to protect you. Under ERISA, you need the actual spousal waiver. So please remember this in a blended family situation. There are many cases where we have successful people, men and women, and they get married and both want to protect their assets for their children from previous relationships. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not inherently bad. It's perfectly normal. But they make this simple error. They think, I've got a beneficiary form. I've got my children named on it. I'm all set. And it doesn't work that way. Even if the kids are on the beneficiary form, even if the deceased father was an ERISA attorney, and even if the new wife signed a prenup, she could have even signed a postnup, could she not have, Chris? And the kids still would have lost it.
Right.
She had to have signed a spousal waiver form. That's an ERISA law, and it takes precedence over a state law, any state law, and any probate law. So anyways, I don't want to beat that horse to death. Let's move on.
Perfect.
Okay. This one, I think we had a question similar to this, but it's a good question. I'll go over it again. I think somewhere over the last year or so, we answered something similar to this, but I don't mind answering a question like this again. Hi, I turn 72, and wait a minute, I usually like to name the state, and no state. You know what it is? When people fill this in from the website, it doesn't require a state be submitted. You have to change that. Anyways, I like to know what state people are in, but no idea where they're from, but we are going to call this gentleman George. He begins, hi, I turn 72 next year in 2021, and I will need to take my required minimum distribution. Must I take it in 2021, or can I postpone it until 2022? I understand if that is possible, I will need to take 2 required minimum distributions in 2022. Did this option disappear, or can I do it? Why don't you answer that part of the question, then I'll get to a second part.
Well, there still is the rule that you must take your first RMD by April of the year following, April 1st of the year following the year the first RMD is due. So that rule is still in place. The thing that's changed is the RMD age moved from 70 and a half to 72. So yes, he can delay that first RMD until April 1st of the year following the year that he turns 72, but he'll have to take 2 RMDs that year because you can't delay all your RMDs. It's only the first one. And if you delay that first one, it's going to happen in the same year that you take your second one as well. So simple answer to that first part.
Perfect. Okay. Then he goes on and asks, if I can postpone my 2021 required minimum distribution until 2022, can I convert my traditional IRA money to a Roth without the IRS considering that an excess contribution? Thank you for your efforts on behalf of your audience. Well, you're welcome, audience. I'll answer the second part because we get this a lot. Please remember, folks, he doesn't tell me when his birthday is, but let's take the worst case scenario, folks. His birthday, in other words, he turns 72, December 31st, 2021, the last day of the year. As Chris said, he could delay, and the whole reason this law exists this way, the delay of the first, is pretty much for folks born on December 31st. Or somewhere in December where they're not going to have much time to get this all done. But if he turns 72 December 31st, 2021, he can delay his first required minimum distribution, or if he misses it, no big deal, he can make it up by taking it before April 1st of 2022. And then, yes, he has to take his year 2022 distribution by December 31st, 2022. But that does not mean from January 1st, 2021 to December 30th, 2021, his IRA is operating under previous rules. His IRA is operating under what I call post-RMD rules. And really what that rule simply says is the first dollars out of your IRA are what, Chris?
First dollars are always RMD dollars if an RMD is due. And his RMD becomes due January 1st of the year he turns 72. So even if he, in your example, didn't turn 72 until December 31st, you know, a year later, one day shy of a year later, his first dollars out that entire year, no matter when he takes them, are going to be considered RMD.
Exactly. And Chris, are RMDs allowed to be converted?
Never.
Exactly.
Period. Underline, exclamation point, whatever you want to put on there. Bold. Never.
So the IRS would consider, if you did that conversion and you try to convert the RMD, that's not allowed. And they would consider that an excess contribution to your 401k, and they would subject it to a 6% penalty every year that it stays in the, excuse me, did I say 401k? I meant to say his conversion to his Roth. He was talking about taking money from his IRA and putting it into a Roth IRA. If he did that any time in 2021, and again, in my example, he doesn't turn 72 until December 31st, in my hypothetical example, does not matter. As Chris pointed out, come January 1st, first dollars out of that account are considered RMDs. RMDs can never, ever, ever be converted. So the IRS would consider, let's just say Chris's RMD was $20,000 and he converted $100,000 on January 2nd. Can't do it January 1st because it's a holiday. The $80,000 is okay. IRS will have no problem with that. They'll tax it. He'll owe taxes on the $80,000. But the $20,000 that went into the Roth IRA, he's also going to owe taxes on that because the IRS is going to consider that a distribution, not a conversion. And distributions and conversions are taxed the same. So that $20,000 will also be taxed. So the full $100,000 will be taxed, Chris.
Yep.
But that $20,000 sitting in the Roth is also going to be subject to a 6% annual excess contribution penalty every year that it stays in the Roth IRA.
Yep.
So do keep that in mind, folks. So anyways, I think we answered a question similar to that.
Just always remember the RMD year, it starts the year you turn 72. That's why we always say it that way. If it was the day you turn 72, we would always describe it that way, and it would be described that way in all the literature. It's, in fact, the year you turn 72 used to be the year you turn 70 and a half. It isn't your birthday itself. It's the year that birthday happens that the RMD becomes due, and it's due on January 1st. They just give you time to pay it, but it's actually due. And they require that they recognize that you can't pick and choose the order in which you distribute money. They've made the rule. The first dollars out are always RMD. That's why you'd run into this problem.
And we run into this problem, or I have seen this problem with other advisors. And a lot of people don't know that that's the case and that's the rule. And I have been asked for the part of the tax code that references that. And I still don't to this day know what part of the tax code that is. I just say Ed Slott because he has drilled that into our head. But for anyone listening, if you do want the part of the tax code, I might be able to find it for you. But it is the rule. It is the law. And a lot of people don't understand that. But now everyone listening to this show hopefully does. Okay, how much more time do we have, if any?
I think we can squeeze one more in as long as it's not too long.
Ew. Well, this one, if you don't go on and on and on, I think we can do it.
Okay. I'll give it my best shot.
No promise if you go on and on and on. All right. I'm not going to read then since, listener, this is Chris is short on time on this. But this email came in a while ago, so I wanted to kind of get to it. I'm not going to read the beginning part, Chris, because it's very long, but I will say he is a 36-year-old professional. He recently found a show, and he is a big fan of the show. Okay, so he's asking a couple of questions. If I convert an IRA to a Roth IRA through a backdoor conversion, by converting all equities in kind, and what that means, folks, let me pause there. A lot of people don't know this. Apparently, this listener does. When you do a conversion, folks, you don't have to sell everything in your IRA, convert cash, and rebuy when it gets into the Roth IRA.
Right.
You can convert assets in kind. In other words, you can tell your IRA custodian, take these specific assets. He's saying he's converting his equities. Take these equities, and the custodian's going to ask the number of shares. They're not going to go by name. Oh, take my Apple stock and convert it. They're going to say how many shares. So you have to give them the exact number of shares. But take these shares, move it to a Roth, call it a conversion. Now, the problem with that is, how much are you actually converting, Chris? You really don't know until after the conversion is done. You might know the shares you're converting and the number. You don't know the dollar amount because it's the value at the end of the trading day when the conversion happens.
Right.
So that kind of ties into his questions, as you'll see in a second or two. Okay, so if I do a backdoor Roth conversion with all equities in kind, am I taxed on the difference between my contributions, and he put in parentheses, remember, they are all after tax because I did not take a deduction. Mm-hmm. So am I taxed on the difference of my contributions value as of the day of conversion or the end of the year on December 31st, 2020? I don't think it's either. Let me explain what he's going to be taxed on. In this case, he's talking about a backdoor folk. So I'm guessing this gentleman earns too much to contribute directly to a Roth IRA. I'm also assuming he has no existing IRAs. And what he's doing, folks, is he's putting money into his Roth. He's buying equities with it.
Well, he's putting it into his traditional IRA first.
Excuse me, into his traditional IRA.
But instead of immediately doing a backdoor, he bought equities and sat on them long enough for their value to change.
Correct. So now the equities, folks, have changed in value. So let's say, I do know he's 36, so let's say he put $6,000 in. And he bought Apple stock with it, since we mentioned Apple in the past. And his $6,000 is now worth $6,500, Chris. And then he does the quote-unquote backdoor by converting this money that he never deducted. So there's $6,000 of after-tax dollars and $500 of gain. Mm-hmm. He converts all $6,500, which he has to do for the backdoor to truly work. So he converts it all, and he's wondering, what does he have to pay taxes on? What does he pay taxes on, Chris?
He's going to be paying taxes on the $500 because any gains that have occurred are not tax-free, only the original contribution that was after tax inside the traditional IRA gets treated always as after tax. It can come out tax-free because taxes were already paid on it, but the $500 in this particular case gets taxed. This is why we encourage people usually to do the backdoor quickly, because if he would have gotten it in there and moved it immediately into the Roth IRA while it was still roughly worth the $6,000, you might not be able to pull it off fast enough for it to be no growth at all if this was on a growth trajectory. He could then have had the $500 tax-free instead of it being taxable, but the delay in enacting this whole backdoor created the taxability of that $500, so it's treated like he's got cream and coffee, the $6,000 after tax, the $500 before tax, and you have to pull it all over, and the $500 will be taxed.
Correct. So it has nothing to do with the December 31st value, listener. It has everything to do with the value on the day of conversion. And you will see that in your statements from the custodian, that on the day of conversion, you converted $6,500. Your basis never changes. So your basis is always $6,000 because you never deducted any of it. So that is always a tax-free conversion. I don't want to say tax-free. You pay taxes on the money to get it into the Roth, but you're not taxed again on that $6,000. There's a lot of disagreements here. One very bright man, Michael Kitsis. You know that. I mean, we're not making that up. Michael Kitsis is a phenomenal, bright man in this industry. But I disagree passionately with him. He still, Chris, recommends people wait to do the back door. He's still worried about the step doctrine rule. And I cannot disagree with Mike more than that. And so does Ed Slott. And Ed Slott is a damn smart man in his own right. The government, after, what was it, the Secure Act, not the Secure Act. What came out before that? The Tax Cut and Jobs Act.
Yes, it was the Tax Cuts and Job Act. Yep.
They all but blessed this backdoor strategy. They came out and specifically said, it is okay. You can do it. We have no problem with it. Right. It's right in there. And ever since then, and even before then, I didn't care, in my opinion, if you did it right away or not. Because the law is very explicit. In 2010, they passed a law that said anyone of any income can do a conversion. There is no income limit on a conversion. There is only an income limit on a contribution. It's, to me, always blessed after 2010. But to this day, Chris, Mike still says to wait, at least as of last year when I was at the AICPA event and he was speaking, he was still recommending to wait. And I didn't talk with him about it because he's going to wonder, who the hell are you? Aren't you the guy that I've argued with in the past? He's probably going to say. But he still does that. I don't know why. I even talked to
I haven't seen him say anything or hear him say anything. I say seeing him because I read his materials. I don't usually listen to him. I haven't seen anything from him over the last year on this topic. So he might have changed his thought process. We don't know. But the last time we definitely have heard him utter
last time
about
I heard
this,
him was
he was still talking
year,
about it. Yep.
In June, yep. Last June. Yep. Anyways, what I'm getting at, folks, and listener who had this question, there's no need, in my opinion, for you to wait. Get the $6,000 in, keep it in cash. Put it in on Monday. When it finally hits your account, Tuesday or Wednesday, you tell your custodian, convert my entire account, please. Get it then into the Roth and then buy whatever equity it is. If you buy it beforehand, you might have a little bit of gain that you have to declare or a little bit of a loss. But again, there's no need to wait anymore. There's still people out there, though, saying you need to wait or you'll fall victim to the step doctrine rule, which is essentially a rule that Congress gives the IRS to say, hey, you shouldn't have done this. You're not eligible. But because you followed all these independent steps where every single step is legit, but the end result of those steps were you doing something you couldn't do, we're going to disallow it. Chris, is there a rule that says you cannot convert an IRA to a Roth IRA?
No.
No. There is no rule that says you can't convert. And the law is also explicit, and it's been explicit since 73. Anyone can put money into an IRA and not deduct it. So there's nothing wrong here, in my opinion, and I still stick to that. Okay. I thought that was a very good question. If we still have time, he's got a few more questions. If not, I'll just
do
one.
No, we don't have any more.
Okay.
Sorry.
So at least we got to his main question. And I know, listener, before you say, hey, what about my other ones? We'll get to those on another show. But you know how Chris is. He goes on and on sometimes. And I apologize. I couldn't get to all of them.
They'll forgive you this time.
I'm hoping they will.
Well, that brings us to the end of another Q&A show here at the Retirement and IRA Show. We appreciate you sending in your questions. We also appreciate you listening. So if you have your own questions, best way to get them to us is go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And you can learn more about us on that website and also submit your questions if you happen to have any. And I'll let Jim get to his weekend and hope his internet improves.
I can't get to the weekend. I still got more work I got to do.
We'll get that done.
With staff. Okay. I'm hoping to break out early. I want to get out at 4:59.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Instead of 5. Yep.
A special early weekend.
I've got that minute totally booked. I know exactly what I want to do with that minute on this Friday.
Okay. Well, take care. I'll talk to you next week, and we'll talk to everyone else next week on another Q&A show. Thanks, everyone.
Talk to you later. Mm-hmm.
Bye.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.